got the meeting minutes, and is there a motion to approve the meeting minutes for June?
I'll move.
Second.
Remy and Bob.
Are we going to be meeting here on a regular basis or just tonight?
I think we're going to talk about that.
Oh, okay.
I believe so.
This is because of the lack of space over our other building, we're going to be moving back over there for the May meeting. But for this meeting and the next meeting, we'll be here.
Oh, okay.
In location. Yeah. We're working out space right now.
We'll put that in on our agenda.
Yeah.
Discussion.
Okay.
And then all in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye.
I'd like to welcome our new educational community member. This is Sherman O'Gord. He is the new principal of Battleground High School. And for the previous, you want me to read your bio?
I don't know.
He was very excited. I've learned a lot more about him sitting next to him. But for the previous 4 years, Mr. Gord was the principal of Covington Middle School in the Evergreen Public School District. Earlier this year, Mr. Gord was associate principal of Heritage School and the dean of students at Union High School and an English teacher at SELA Middle School and Mountain View High School. So we're very lucky to have such a educational focused person in on our team. I don't know if you'd like to say a couple of words about your plan here or why you would want to be a part of the group.
I've been in the school systems for over 20 years, and I've been wanting to get involved just locally for quite some time. And Chief Richardson brought this up. I did actually ask a few people at our district office, and they said, no, they're too busy. And I talked with my wife about it, and she thought it was a good idea. So any way I can give back and hopefully contribute something, I'm just happy to be here.
Highly thought of, so we're happy to have you here. I thought we would go around since Termino. Sharp, he goes by Sharp.
One syllable.
But it is a very nice name. So Sharp, thank you. Maybe we'll go around and do our introductions, and then we can introduce the public. We have some public comments tonight. I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I'm a veteran small animal veterinarian, and I represent the Doctor of Veterinary Medicine in Clark County.
I'm Stephanie. I'm a nurse, and I represent a nurse practicing in Clark County.
I'm Sandy Brown, and I'm representing the Consumer Public Health Union.
Paul Childers, and I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
Alan Melnick, I'm the Public Health Director and Health Officer.
I'm Roxanne Wolf, I'm staff at Public Health.
Lydia Gurman, Public Health Admin.
Marla Sanger, I'm representing the community on this council.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley. I'm a community health nurse, but I sit on this council as a non-elected representative from the City of Vancouver.
I'm Arlene Dorsey, and I'm representing medical doctors of Clark County.
I'm Katie, and I
represent the youth
of Clark
County. Remy Usen, representing the dentist in Clark County.
I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief at Battleground, and I represent the law enforcement council, which is all of the police chiefs in the county plus the county sheriff.
Mark Collier, representing Septic designers, installers, and operation maintenance specialists.
John Roth, I work for Clark Public Utilities. I represent public water providers.
Dave Scott, city manager of City of Washougal. I represent all the other cities as a non-elected rep. The little cities.
We do have some public here, and so I think we have three that we have on our list, and one is Lynette Paulson, who is a nurse from the community, public health, and then Alan Friend here, and then Tammy Rivera,
yeah,
who is also majoring in nursing from Western Governors University, and if you guys wanted to spend just a couple minutes explaining kind of what your interest is here, and you wanted to spend 2 minutes of public comment.
So I'm here as I'm actually doing my community health project right now, and so just trying to get some idea of councils such as this that are actually working to improve the health of the community. So.
I'm also one of the advanced nursing students. I'm doing a community project right now on disaster management with community focus. So with this advisory council, I'll be interested in the incident command system, the flu updates, measles updates, things along those lines.
Great. I'm
I'm also doing my community and public health nursing for my advanced degree. I came mostly for tonight is the fire. I'm doing mine on suicide prevention, teen related. So the firearm and the ACES articles are very interesting to me.
And then we have some other public comments.
I'm Nina. I'm a concerned mom. I just wanted to speak about the bill that you guys are proposing to use. So we're just here to kind of voice our concerns.
Okay. Well, we can have some time to have a brief comment if you'd like to do that.
Thank you.
This would be the time.
Oh. sorry, I'm so nervous. I just wanted to thank you guys, first of all, for serving our community. And I'm all pro informed consent, and I believe that a parent should be informed of all the facts when it comes to measles or any kind of vaccine. And in order for us to be vaccinating our kids, or for me to be vaccinating my kids, I would like to know the pros, the cons, the dangers, the side effects that the vaccines have, including the ingredients. And when I showed up to my pediatrician, he was just saying that it's all safe and for everyone, and I should just vaccinate. And when I brought out questions, he wasn't very informed of anything that has to do with vaccines. So I'm just here to say, if you could please vote no on mandatory vaccines or measles, I would greatly, greatly appreciate it.
I'm Katrina Nager. I live in Battleground, Washington, and I'm also a concerned mom. I have the same concern about the vaccines, that we're not really given every ingredient and all the possible side effects. There is a lot of pressure that we feel from doctors, even just voicing that concern, so it automatically kind of gives you a fear of, well, why is it such a hot topic if I just have a question about it, you know? But I also recently have found out that there's a lawsuit against some of the vaccines that they're proclaiming that they're safe for pregnant women when there was never really a study even done. So I don't think we should be promoting or advertising something that's never been proven to be safe.
Hi, my name is Yulia, and I am a concerned mom and a concerned daughter. My dad has leukemia, and I'm not sure how many of you know that MMR is a live vaccine. It sheds a virus for 4 weeks. And it's just devastating to, and that virus is grown in a lab. In addition, there was a recent lawsuit against Department of Health and Human Services. So ICANN and Del Bigtree, he's a journalist, and Robert Kennedy Jr., they filed a lawsuit against HHS because vaccines have not been tested for safety in the last 32 years, as it was mandated by Congress in 1986 when the National Childhood Injury Act was mandated. So in 32 years, we were supposed to file a report to Congress every 2 years with how they improved and tested vaccines for safety. Neither of that has been done. And in fact, state of Washington has connected with, or Donald Trump, what's the memorandum?
They wrote a memorandum
to Donald Trump asking to help to repeal the Act of 1986, which has given pharmaceutical companies a liability, and we cannot sue them. I personally know two families whose kids were vaccinated and injured. Those kids have siblings. They are more prone to vaccine injury because their sibling had injury. So thank you so much. Please consider our parents, because we love our children. We're trying to raise them and healthy, feeding them right. Please, thank you so much for your time.
Any other comments?
Anybody else?
I agree with everything they're saying. Vaccines are dangerous.
there have been, Congress has ruled that they are unavoidably unsafe. So that's a ruling in one of the lawsuits. Everybody can handle them. And with current schedule, CDC schedule, it's ridiculous the amount of toys and kids are being injected. It's like when you, if you feed them, which is ridiculous, it goes straight into our bodies. And I've read somewhere, when babies are teething, they're like, everything that's in vaccines has, can easily be. Yes.
Yeah, because it goes straight into the vein, it goes, it's not the same thing as digesting something through the stomach. And there's a lot of ingredients that will, like the aluminum, it breaks the blood-brain barrier. And obviously,
it's also that absorbed, toxins are always also absorbed by organs.
I think what we're all trying to say, if there's any side effect or harm that can be caused to our bodies or our baby's bodies, it shouldn't be mandatory. It should be a choice for every parent to choose. Okay? Yes.
Okay. Are there any comments that anybody wants the chance to present?
I'm a mother of three. I'm Ina Kulik, and I also support the parents and everybody who's willing to do vaccines or not to have a choice. My kids, they, all three of them, they have vaccines. I just think it's right that people have a choice.
Okay. All right. So if you guys would like to stay for the meeting, you guys are welcome to, or if you want to.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
So we'll start with Roxanne.
Oh, you're
going to
leave.
I will drive.
You will drive.
I'll wait for Lydia when she gets back. Yeah, we have a little the update on several different things. We've got a measles update, a flu update. We want to talk about our incident command system, which is we called up the incident command system to help with some of the surge capacities to respond to the measles outbreak, and then there's some other things in here. All right.
So just we're, even though we've been paying all of our most of our attention to measles over the last couple of months, other communicable diseases have been taking a holiday. So we're in the midst of the flu season. I'm going to show you a graph in a minute. The way we define flu season is when people go to the hospital, go to the doctor's office, and get a test done for flu if they have a respiratory illness. If more than 10% of the specimens collected in the county are positive for influenza, then that we call it the flu season. So we're well above that. We're actually up to 43.5%. And nationally, and in Washington State, we're in the flu season as well. And most of these are influenza A. There's influenza A and B. A tends to be a lot more serious than B, but most of them are influenza A. Just to give you an idea, I put this graph in here. These are previous years. On the bottom here is the weeks. This is the first week of January. This is 10 weeks before January, so the fall. And this is January on to February, March. This is this year. So here's a 10% threshold. And you can see we started late, but we're reaching high levels right now. We're up to close to 45% of the samples being positive. Okay, I want to give you a little bit of bad news is there's different flavors of influenza A. They're based on the antigens on the virus, the proteins on the virus, and actually H1N1 tends to be milder than H3N2 tends to be more severe. And you can see early in the season, it was predominantly H1N1, and now it's more H3N2, which is not really good news. So the flu season can go on for another month or two, easily for another couple of months. And we're looking at a more severe type of flu right now. It's not too late to get your flu shot. It takes 2 weeks to build up immunity. Flu vaccine is safe, like other vaccines, I might add. And this, from the preliminary data from the CDC, although we're not going to know until the end of the flu season, is about, it's about 47% effective, which isn't bad, that bad for flu vaccine. It's still the best thing you can do to prevent yourself from getting the flu. I don't know if there's any other questions about influenza. I think that's the last slide.
What about deaths from flu?
You know, every year there's tens of thousands of deaths in the United States from flu. It could be as high. Yeah, I don't have the data for that so far, and we're still in the midst of it.
Alan?
Yes?
The vaccine that people received this year, is it protective against both of them?
Yeah, both H1N1 and H3N2.
Thank you.
And one or two Bs, depending on whether you got the trivalent or quadrivalent vaccine. And like I say, it's a reasonably, 47% is better than it has been in some other years. Still the best thing you can do to prevent yourself. And even if you do get the flu, if you've had the vaccine, it's less likely to be, less likely to be as severe. Influenza is nothing to poo-poo it. It's a very severe respiratory illness with high fever, complications, and you know, a major cause of death during flu season.
What about, is there any particular population group that is being impacted more? Like in previous years, it's been young adults and...
Well, we have, you know, older, you know, the elderly are particularly at risk. And we track the number of long-term care facilities that have outbreaks. And I know, you know, 1 year we had like 20 outbreaks in long-term care facilities. So it's a particular issue in long-term care facilities. I don't have the numbers. I get that for you later in terms of the number of long-term care facilities where we've had outbreaks.
And I can, what I can say too is that we've had several already this year.
Yeah. We have one right now, just now
that
today.
We're dealing with right now.
So flu outbreak in a long-term care facility is defined as one case of lab-confirmed flu and at least one other case of respiratory illness compatible with flu. And it can spread pretty rapidly in long-term care facilities. When we do have, the long-term care facilities call us, we have instructions for them, both on our website as well as our staff will talk to them and tell them about what precautions they need to take and what to do. Yes?
We had three people where I worked that came down with the flu and they were hit pretty hard.
Yes.
But it didn't go any further than that. Everybody else so far has been okay, but it was heavy duty.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just light. It was
it's bad.
Very strong.
Should we go on? Any other questions? We'll go on to measles. So, we've been dealing with this for more than 2 months. So, the first case of measles that we became aware of, and by the way, there's a lot of misinformation going out there about the disease as well as the vaccine, and I'm not going to get it. You know, if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them. But the first case was actually seen at Memorial Urgent Care on December 31st. That was the first case we know about. So, you know, you've heard that we've got 73 cases in Clark County. And I got to tell you that that's the cases we know about. To be, measles is a notifiable condition in most states, virtually all states, including Washington. So when it's diagnosed, it's reported to us. But I'm sure there's people out there who have measles and maybe suffered for a couple of weeks and didn't go to a doctor or get seen. So there are cases we don't know about. I've been asked questions about who was the first case, who was patient zero, how did it get here? There are cases out there that we don't know about because they don't come to our attention. So I just want you all to know that. The first one we knew about was, the lab was the one at Memorial Urgent Care on December 31st. This lab confirmed on January 4th. And we were concerned about that because measles, number one, is, this is one disease that scares me more than many of the others. One is, it's exquisitely contagious. If you have one person with measles and you have people around them who are not vaccinated, nine out of 10 of people in contact will get sick with measles, will get the infection. And it's airborne spread, and it can actually linger in the environment in the air for 2 hours after a person with measles has left the room. So it's one of the most contagious viruses known to mankind. And the other thing that scares me about measles is it can be a potentially lethal infection. So it's not, there's misinformation going on about its benign disease of childhood. Before measles vaccine became routinely used in the 60s, 400 to 500 people died every year in the United States. There are about 50,000 hospitalizations every year, and there are about 4,000 cases of measles encephalitis, which is a swelling of the brain that can lead to deafness and, you know, among other things. So it's a serious disease that's exquisitely contagious. Fortunately, 100% preventable. Yes.
Can you speak a little bit too, because I think there has been some comments even tonight regarding shedding, you know, vaccination shedding. Can you speak to that?
That was an interesting comment, and I didn't want to get into debate. So the one of the pieces of misinformation out there that's going on out there, and actually some of the language got into one of the bills that we can talk about, is that people who get the vaccine shed the virus and they can infect other people. The vaccine's been around for 50 years. There's been numerous studies. There was a big systematic review in the journal Vaccine of millions of doses of measles vaccine have been given out. There's never been a documented case. There's no documented case ever of human-to-human transmission of the vaccine virus. I was concerned hearing some of the talk tonight because somebody who's got leukemia, the people around that person should be vaccinated. You can give vaccine to family members of somebody who's immunosuppressed. They don't shed the vaccine virus, they don't infect others. But concern about somebody who's immunosuppressed, who's on chemotherapy, who is at risk from wild measles, from measles infection itself. I know in one of the schools we had, there was concern because we had a kid with cancer, and we have kids like that in our schools who may be on chemotherapy and immunosuppressed, and I really worry about those folks, and it's even more reason why all of us need to be vaccinated so we can create kind of like a cocoon around these people who can't be vaccinated. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it when we talk about our response, because I'm not only concerned about people with cancer and or who are immunosuppressed, but infants are too young for the vaccine, and then we've got pregnant women who are, you know, should have been vaccinated as children, but if they were not and they get pregnant, they're at particular risk for complications. So measles is a really bad disease. And, you know, the other question is, well, we haven't had any deaths from measles in several years. You know why we haven't had any deaths from measles in several years? Because 90% of the population is vaccinated. So the mortality rate from measles is 1 to 3 per 1,000. As bad as it is, we've had 73 cases in Clark County. If we had hundreds or thousands, I can guarantee you that we would have deaths. And that would bring us back to the days before vaccine. So anyway, things started getting bad by mid-January. We had a number of suspect cases and confirmed cases. So we ramped up. I know you're interested in incident command. So we went into incident command because we knew that given measles and how it behaves, and given the large numbers of unvaccinated folks we have in the county, that things could get a lot worse. And I don't have those maps for you, but for measles, to prevent transmission in a community, for herd immunity, you need about 95% of the population vaccinated or immune. And there are schools and school districts and school buildings, and you can look at it, and again, I didn't bring the maps, where the immunization rates are far lower than that. We're talking about some schools with immunization rates in the 40, 50%, which scares me a whole lot. So anyway, so we knew we were gonna need to ramp up. So onward to the next slide. So what's cool about Instant Command System, I think it was, I don't know if it was developed for natural disasters or wildfires, but it's a great system for actually creating an organization that can manage an event. And what's really good about it is that you can scale it up. So you can actually start with a couple of people, and as the event gets bigger, it's easy to plug in folks to resources to deal with larger events. What's really also great about it, so it works for, you can plan your wedding with Incident Command System. It also helps coordinate response between different agencies. So when we went into Incident Command, our council declared a state of emergency. We went into Incident Command, so did the State Department of Health. And the ICS system with its liaisons really makes it great to communicate and work together across agencies. You might remember a few years ago we had that hepatitis C situation with a drug diverter at Peace Health, and we went into joint incident command with Peace Health, and it helped us really deal with dealing with the hepatitis C situation there. And it also establishes a common standardized process for managing an event and also for planning. Okay. It really clarifies a chain of command. It's a great structure, so it's, you know, you have an incident command, it's broken up, and I think we have another slide that shows this, but you have an operations section, which really does the actual, manages the event. You have a, oh, here it is. You have a planning section, which helps look forward and predict what you're gonna need and what resources you might need. You have logistics, which basically gets the resources you need, whether they be laptops or people or transportation or whatever. And so the people in operations don't have to worry about it. They can just ask and logistics will take care of that. And also you have a finance administration section that I'm gonna be showing you some information soon in terms of how much this has cost us. Can you go back for a second? I wanna make sure I've covered everything. No, back. Okay. Yeah, the other thing about incident command is we define operational periods and we set objectives in terms of what we need to reach so we can track how we're doing. Okay, that's good, thank you. So we worked with, like I said, we worked with other agencies. We had a liaison who worked with, for example, the State Department of Health. It also reaches out to the schools. This, and I wanna, you know, we have some educational representative here. I gotta tell you, the school districts were incredible partners throughout this. We had three school districts involved, Vancouver, Evergreen, and Battleground, and they were great to work with. And our liaison officer helped with that, you know, make sure we were communicating really well. The other thing is we had a public we all had PIOs and public information officers, and actually with ICS you can set up a JIC, which is a Joint Information Center, or a JIS, a Joint Information System, so you make sure that the different agencies involved, in this case us and DOH and maybe the schools, are giving out similar messages. We make sure that we get information out there. We also, our PIO basically helps us get requests. Yeah, if you hadn't noticed, we got tons of requests from media, and this has been kind of national and actually international news. Okay. So things are getting better over the past 10 days. I'm going to talk to you in a minute about what the work that went into this. We will define the outbreak as over when, well, I'll feel good about it if we go 21 days without it between the last case and the next. I think the last case is on the 14th, I believe, of March. The reason I say 21 days is the incubation period for measles. If you get exposed and you're susceptible, you will develop symptoms somewhere between 7 and 21 days after. If we go one incubation period, 21 days after without another case, I'll be happy. And we will declare it over if we go 42 days, two incubation periods without a case. And the reason we do that is, as mentioned earlier, there are cases we don't know about in the community. So that's just gives us a little bit, be a little bit more conservative before we say we're out of the woods. We moved the incident back to the regular folks, the communicable disease team. Although we are still getting some help from the state on the non-measles communicable diseases, we still have 63 cases we're actively monitoring. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Given the 42 days since the last case, it's now mid-March. It could be May or even June before we're out of this. And like I said, Department of Health is still providing some resources. Okay. I wanted to give you an idea of the work that goes into this and how we work an outbreak. So measles, like I said, is a notifiable condition. So doctors, hospitals, labs, they have a case, they have to report it to us. When we get a case report, our staff interview them. And they interview them for a couple of things. One is they want to know when their symptoms began, because measles, as I said, how contagious it is, it becomes contagious from the moment you develop symptoms. So the early symptoms of measles, and this is what also makes measles bad, especially at this time of year, the early symptoms of measles are runny nose, cough, fever, and conjunctivitis or red or pink eye. How common are those symptoms at this time of year? Really common. And that, those symptoms can go on for several days. Then the rash develops. So you could have measles without knowing you have the measles. And then the rash develops and you're contagious for another 4 days. So you can be contagious for, you know, easily 8 days. So we will interview people and ask them, where have you been during the time you were contagious? And some of the folks have been to multiple different places. And you've heard about that. We'll talk about that in a minute. The other thing we'll ask them about is, where were you between 7 to 21 days before the beginning of your symptoms? Because we want to get an idea of where they might have been exposed, so we know that there might be other people out there who, you know, we might be able to identify exposure sites and warn the public about that, because there could be some other people who are at those exposure sites and may develop symptoms. Does that all make sense? So that's a lot of interviewing with each case that goes on. Okay, so we find out where they've been while they were contagious, and they can fall into several categories. One is they may be at a large a public setting, like we had a case that you may be aware of at the Moda Center where the Blazers play. We've also had some cases at the airport. We're not going to be able to identify everybody, you know, like the 20,000 folks at the Moda Center, you know, who's unimmunized there, who should be particularly concerning. But we will get notify the public about those exposure sites if they were there, and especially if they were unvaccinated, we will, you know, we'll get information about what the symptoms might be and explain to people, don't, if you're unvaccinated, you're exposed to one of these public sites, don't just walk into an emergency room or a doctor's office if you get symptoms, because then you will expose a whole bunch of other people. And who sits in a doctor's office or an ED? Pregnant women, infants, people with immune disorders, not the kind of folks you want to expose to measles. So we'll get public notices out. We've had a number of cases and exposure sites at schools, and we'll talk about that in a minute. If we identify a case at a school when they were contagious, we will identify staff as well as students who are unimmunized, susceptible, and we'll exclude them from school and other public settings for 21 days. We'll also actively monitor them, and we mean by actively monitor them is we will contact them every day to see whether they're developing symptoms or not. And we, given the sheer volume, in some cases we use something called IVR, which is a automatic, you know, robocall kind of thing where people can give answers using their touch tone. But this gets pretty complicated also, because not only a concern about the school building, but some of these kids ride, I learned a lot about bus routes, and kid contagious on a bus, we're concerned about the bus driver as well as other staff, as well as some of these bus routes go to multiple schools. So we have to do all that work and identify where they are and then work with the school to exclude them for 21 days. Kind of one of the biggest nightmares is a case that shows up at an emergency room or a doctor's office and with no warning ahead of time, and they're unable to take the appropriate precautions. And by the way, we got information out to providers. We've gotten regular information out to providers about how to safely seat patients who might have measles without infecting the rest of your patients. But, and remember, you can be contagious for 2 hours after you've left the room. People can still get the disease. So we have to work with the clinic or the ED to find out who was in there up to 2 hours after the patient with measles left. And we have to get their contact information, call them and interview them and identify with whether any of them were susceptible or also whether they fell into risk categories. Not only do we have to do that, we have to, when we contact those folks, we have to ask them, did you bring anybody else with you to your visit who might not be on the patient roster? And then we have to contact them for the same reason, because they were there, even though they weren't on the roster and the clinic might not have known about them. If we can identify those who are susceptible, we have to monitor them, do active monitoring for 21 days and recommend that they self-quarantine at home for those days. If this is really unlikely, but if they're unimmunized, and by the time we do all this work and by the time we know about the case, we can identify folks who are eligible for vaccine, and we do it within 72 hours, we can give them vaccine. That almost never occurs, given the time lag for the case to be reported to us and do all this work. But this one is really important, and we actually use this. If they're in the emergency room, and we're working against time here, and there was an unimmunized pregnant woman there, infants who are too young for the vaccine, or people who are immunosuppressed, if we do it within 6 days, we can get them immunoglobulin, which is passive antibody that can protect them. And we did that a number of times. So then we have to do that for anybody else who might have been there. So you can imagine the amount of work that it did to, it took to do that. Okay.
Who pays for the immunoglobulin?
That's a really good question. I mean, insurance might pay for it. I think we paid for it. The providers may pay for it, but it's not cheap.
Can I say something really quick?
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. We work with a lot of the hospitals as well, and Peace Health has been absolutely wonderful.
Incredible.
They brought in, and we normally don't have a lot of immunoglobulin within the community because you don't really need it. So we've actually scoured all across the world, really, to bring this in, and Peace Health has been a wonderful partner in helping us get this out to the public.
And actually, pregnant women need IV immunoglobulin because the maximum dose of IM is not enough for somebody, for an adult-sized person. So pregnant women get IV immunoglobulin. The infants get IM immunoglobulin.
Alan, I have a question. For those you identified who are susceptible and who you're, essentially asking to self-quarantine, hopefully, I'm wondering what the level of cooperation has been on that.
That's a really good question. So I know there were at least 3 cases in Multnomah County who were exposed in Clark County that we work with them, and they were actively monitoring them that stayed home when they got sick. They had stayed home. And we have some cases here, but it's a really good question. We're going to be working with the CDC on a paper on this. But one of the papers we're going to work on, I'm going to talk about the others, is how effective was our quarantine measures. I mean, we weren't going to put ankle bracelets on people, and we weren't going to use Bob and his crew to circle their houses. That was not feasible. But I got to be honest with you, we're like in the pre-vaccine era here with the folks who are unimmunized, and this is the kind of stuff that public health did in the 19th century and early 20th century, before their vaccines. We used quarantine and isolation, and it works. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to find out the answer to your question once we have all the data, because we have a database and we're looking at that. We'll have information about, the folks who were doing active monitoring, and those folks who got sick, how many of them were at home and didn't expose anybody else. So it's a great question, and that's hopefully one of the things we're going to learn from this, and we will publish it. It's one of the questions we've asked. So the other question we're asking is, how effective is immunoglobulin, for example? We're going to be asking that question as well. Although there is some good data on that. Okay. So given what I've said about the work involved, we had 54 sites, and you can see the different breakdowns, 15 schools, and then we had all these other locations. So the other thing you might hear about, you know, I just want to make sure you guys know this, because you heard, you know, I said you can't get the vaccine virus from anybody else. We have had people, you know, if you're immunized with a vaccine for the first time, there's about 5% folks who could develop a rash, and we could detect some of the viral DNA in the urine and the nasopharyngeal swabs. We need to do that because we want to distinguish between a vaccine rash and a virus rash. But those folks don't infect other people and they don't shed the virus. I just want to make sure if you read that stuff, you'll know about it. But there is no vaccine virus shedding. That has been debunked a long time ago. I want to make sure folks know that. Okay, so you can imagine the amount of work that went into this. Okay, next slide. The other point I want to make is that most, the vast majority of folks, we've had four adults, and everybody else of the set of the, this is a few days earlier, so it was, we had 70 cases. Virtually everybody else had been children. Fortunately, we haven't had any infected infants, and we could talk about that. But these cases are all, you know, most of them are one and above, and those are all cases that should have been vaccinated, which gets me to the next slide. The vast majority of folks, there are seven folks who we couldn't verify one way or the other what their immunization status was. We had two people, which was 3% of the total, which had had one of the two shots. But everybody else that we know about was unimmunized. So we are seeing this disease in an unimmunized population. And believe me, the disease is many, many orders of magnitude worse than anything that would ever befall you with a vaccine, which is safe. Okay.
Have you seen these parents change their minds, for example, after their kids have...
I'm going to show you a couple of other slides, so that might get at that in a minute. But the answer is we have had, I've spoken to some pediatricians who've had formerly vaccine hesitant parents actually decide to vaccinate their kids. So, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more when I show you the information on immunizations. There's so much misinformation going on social media that, and I agree with some of the comments here. These are parents who care about their kids, but it's scary to them. And some of the misinformation is really very sophisticated. You might recall that several years ago, there was an outbreak in Minnesota in the Somali population. Historically, Somali population had very high vaccination rates, and then there were some cases of autism in the community, and the anti-vaccination folks convinced them that their autism cases were related to the vaccine. They stopped vaccinating, and they had an outbreak of measles in that population. But those are parents who care about their kids. They're just hearing this information that can be very sophisticated, even though it's nonsense, but it's, you know, it looks really good. There's a group called Physicians for Informed Consent, and you go to their website, and the information is all nonsense, but it looks accurate and looks believable.
So, Alan, one question about those two that just had one vaccine. That was a concern that we had, and my daughter's pediatrician called, and my two-year-old grandson got his second vaccine.
Yeah.
And because those kids were somewhat vulnerable between 2 and 5 with just one.
Right. So as long as it's 28 days after the first vaccine, that was fine. The question also came up about from pediatricians is, should we give an extra early vaccination to kids between the ages of 6 and 11 months? So if you're traveling internationally to a measles endemic country, there's a lot of measles, the recommendation is to, if you have an infant that you're taking with them and they're between 6 and 11 months of age, give them that extra vaccine. They still require the two in childhood. We advise against that, and the reason we advise against that is that there's some literature that shows if you get the vaccine between 6 and 11 months, you're going to get a blunted response. And part of, you know, one reason for that, and the reason we don't vaccinate infants, is that maternal antibody passed through the placenta kind of protects the infant but also blocks the response. It seems like if you give an early vaccine, subsequent the antibody response to subsequent doses is also blunted. So if you're going to a country where there's lots of cases of measles, it makes sense to vaccinate a 6 to 11 month old. But here, where we've had 70 cases in a county of close to 500,000 people, it's not worth it to get that blunted response. So we recommend it against that. So we spent a lot of time talking to our CDC colleagues. I've forgotten more about measles than I ever knew. I mean, I've learned a lot.
But is it standard now that they're immunizing 2 and 3 year olds?
Yeah, I haven't really made that recommendation because at first,
I mean, it just happened.
The first dose of vaccine is 93% effective.
Yeah,
so am I going to say go out and vaccinate all? You know, I want to get the kids who are unvaccinated and put the energy into that. Is it wrong to do that? No, as long as it's 28 days after the first one. Okay, so we've actually up to 73. We actually excluded close to 1,000 kids from school. These are the number of interviews, the letters sent. We've had up to 839 people on active surveillance. 237 people have responded. When we passed that emergency declaration, we were able to implement mutual aid agreements. We had people in our health department. We had a number of people from state health department. They were great. They were taxed also. We had people from other local health jurisdictions. At one point, we had a couple of people from two small health departments in Idaho that were helping us out. We had people from CDC on site. They were great. Great partnership with CDC. So we had 237 responders. We have about, at Clark County Public Health, we got about 110 employees. At any one time when we're really busy on this, we had 30 to 40 of our staff working on this. It's like a third of our staff, which I think you may have read the article in the Columbian that we were pulling environmental health staff. We weren't getting to some of the other things as quickly as we could have, because it was all hands on deck for the measles outbreak. Okay, and so far, we've spent, and this was a few days ago, $700,000. The state has spent around $1 million. We're well into seven figures on this. And what really pains me is this is money that is spent on something that was 100% completely and utterly preventable. And given how precious public health dollars are, to be spending it on something that shouldn't have happened in the first place is what you get to hear me pontificate here is really concerning. I think that might be, is that it? Oh, question that was asked. So this is the first week of January, second week, third week. So the blue bar is the 5-year average of immunizations received during that week in the past 5 years, and the green bar is the number of immunizations received in the first several weeks of 2019. These are for kids to 0 to 18. So you can see the number of immunizations went up hundreds of percent. But given the number of kids in our schools in K through 12, it's great that we immunized here 1,000 instead of 219. But to get the rates up in the schools, we're talking about thousands and thousands of kids who are unimmunized. So we have a long way to go, and you notice that as things stabilize, these numbers are dropping. So my concern about this is how sustainable it is. I think we're going to get complacent again. The misinformation and that's going on social media is going to continue to go on, and we'll be back where we were. These outbreaks are inevitable given our vaccination rates. The next one is for adults. Same thing, large numbers, but petered off a little bit later on, which is why we need, and this is where FACT comes in, why we need some policy changes about this. And I think that's it. Well, you probably saw the media reports. That's right, we have the Surgeon General too. So this has been national news. I don't know if it's national infamy for Clark County. We've been on every major network. We were even on the Comedy Channel on The Daily Show. I don't know if anybody saw that. Lewis Black noticed. We've been in media markets all across the country, Washington Post, New York Times. We've been in international. We've been interviewed by international outlets. It's Clark County, for whatever reason, has made the big time. So, and then we got the Surgeon General here that you're going to...
Yeah, we had the Surgeon General, so that was a really big deal.
Thank you. Thank you for what you do to protect the health of the people.
Go ahead.
No worries. The Surgeon General came out, and he specifically, he was doing a tour of the West Coast, and he was on his way to Seattle, but he specifically wanted to stop and see Clark County because of the response, and he wanted to meet with our incident command teams, and he wanted to get basically this information that Dr. Melnick has been providing tonight. And he was very, very impressed. But we wanted to share with you what he said, and we thought it was really, really telling and really great timing. So we can go ahead and show the clip. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for what you do to protect the health of the people in your state, because, oh my gosh, 4,000 follow-ups.
It's loud enough, can you hear?
Yeah, go ahead.
Like I said, I've with the health commissioner doing it. Thank you. Thank you for what you do to protect the health of the people in your state, because, oh my gosh, 4,000 follow-ups. And like I said, I've with the health commissioner doing it during Ebola, dealt with other, we had a measles outbreak. We had measles at the Super Bowl. We had the Super Bowl. In Indy. So you think about, you know, Super Bowl Village, trying to follow up on people. And I know how tough it is. And one of the problems with public health is that no one ever appreciates you when things are going well. They just blame you when things are going poorly. And then it's always, where were you? Why weren't you here sooner? So part of my job, really, in my opinion, and I say this because it is the job of the Surgeon General in general, but a lot of Surgeons General haven't had public health experience coming in. And so one of the unique things that I try to bring to the role is to help folks understand what public health actually is and what it's actually like to do a contact tracing, to do an investigation. The steps that it takes, the time that it takes, the dedication that it takes. Folks don't realize that when there's an outbreak, many of you all are putting in overtime on top of overtime to make sure the job gets done, because you all are committed to your mission. You're passionate, and you're going to make sure we do right by the people in our communities more so than you're going to punch out when it's time to get off work. And so, thank you for what you do each and every day. I appreciate it, and I consider it my job to block for you guys so that you can run the ball down the field and keep doing good work. And I consider it my job to lift up the great work that you're doing. And if anyone gives you any guff, you send them to me. I'll take care of them for you. Thank you. Thank you for what you do.
Wow, that was an awesome point.
Very nice.
Yeah, we have a few other pictures too when he was here, so we wanted to share those with you as well. This is also our Secretary of Health, Dr. Wiesman. Yeah, that'd be great. And this is one of our public health nurses, Diane Welsh, who is actually, she used to work for us and she retired, and she came back as a volunteer, and she put hours and hours and hours, and she's actually still there continuing to
there
help
today,
us
yep.
as well. So he was getting a briefing on basically the briefing that you all just had. So we'll go ahead. And then here he is addressing the incident command teams, which was really awesome. And then here he is with some of our counselors, which was a great photo op moment. And then this is my favorite picture of all, the selfie with the Surgeon General. So that's going to go on our website. This is just part of the team, certainly a very small part of the team, but it was really a great morale boost, especially since they had been working, as he mentioned, hours and hours and hours. They worked weekends, they worked well into the night. There were several nights where they worked till almost midnight. So it's just been a wonderful opportunity to see the dedication of these
folks. I think at one point I'd spoken to one of the nurses who'd been working 12 days straight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, so that was it. Culmination. Oh, legislative update.
I thought that you mentioned the other national. How many? There's five other national measles outbreaks going on right now that are not.
So there's an outbreak going on in New York. You probably heard
of
There's an outbreak going on in Texas.
In Texas.
I don't know.
And these are different strains of measles than...
So the one in Texas is a Philippine strain. The one here is a D8, which is a strain that's been circulating in Eastern Europe, but now here as well. They're all susceptible to the vaccine. The vaccine gets all of them.
Right. The New York one with somebody
in... I believe the New York one is in a Orthodox Jewish community, and where they've been transit back and forth with counterparts in Israel. Israel has high vaccination rates, but this little community within Israel apparently has low vaccination rates. And then, you know, I mean, there's been all kinds of outbreaks. I get asked, is this a particular community? There was an article in Vox that I think had some inaccuracies in it that talked about this being in a Russian-speaking population. We've had some cases there, but we've also had cases that are not Russian-speaking. So we have enough unimmunized populations to go around here, not confined to just one group.
Well, I immediately went to my doctor to give some blood and see if I was okay. And she described it this way. She says, you can sit in a room full of people with measles and chastise them for not having their vaccine. So that's where I am.
That's great.
So.
Good.
I have a question. When a situation like this arises, which hopefully is rare, but we know it's going to happen again.
It's inevitable.
Time. Is there, and maybe this already happened and I was missing in action during most of this, but are you able to employ the resources that exist within the FAC group membership in a situation like this, call upon members of our committee to step in and help out in different ways?
Go ahead.
Well, I think part of the challenge with an outbreak like this, one of the challenges we had was really with people who had communicable disease nursing experience, mm-hmm. and epidemiological experience, people that are able to take a look at the data and really help us to map out, mm-hmm. where we think we're going to be in a few days. So we were doing all these epi curves to try to predict, mm-hmm. what kind of staffing we were going to need and what kind of resources we were going to need. And it's like having a big dartboard and you throw a dart and hope for the best kind of a thing. But it's, so I think it depends on what kind of an event it is. Mm-hmm. But certainly I think that one of the things that this group can really help with is that advocacy around making sure people are vaccinated, mm-hmm. and get the right information. I think, John, you and I were talking earlier today. It's very easy for parents who are already concerned to get kind of sucked in with this bad information because they're already worried and it ends up being an echo chamber for them, right? Mm-hmm. They're already concerned about a vaccine, do I vaccinate my children? And then they hear this stuff that's scary, mm-hmm. and it just convinces them. So it's really up to all of us to make sure that we don't shame people. You know, we were talking about that earlier. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is really educate them and give them an opportunity to really look at the data and the information, not in an echo chamber kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Because that's when that misinformation just really gets out of hand. So the other thing that we know is that, especially in some of these, some very close populations, a lot of times, people don't, I think, John, you mentioned it, why don't people just get information from their pediatricians? A lot of times they will go to their mom, they'll go to their sister or their brother, they'll go to their neighbor. They take that information as gospel, whereas with what information they're getting from their own pediatrician, they sort of disregard because they've gotten information from other trusted sources. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do a better job of at Public Health is really getting to make sure that outreach that we're doing is make sure that we understand where they are coming from and make sure that we give them an opportunity to really have this discussion, get their fears out, have a really robust discussion so that they can, in the end make those decisions.
When you heard from the comments here, I think it's really clear that we have an issue with trust, mm-hmm. some of the conspiracy theories that it's Big Pharma and all that. Mm-hmm. One of the things we might do is, since we might work, we have faith-based coffee, and we talked about working with, because we've had some exposures at some of the churches, so we're hopeful that maybe we can leverage something like faith-based coffee and work with some of the religious leaders in the community who might be more trusted than we are to reach out to these populations. I think we need to come up with some new methods of reaching out. And I agree with Roxanne. I think the last thing we want to do is point fingers at parents who don't vaccinate and blame people. But I think we need to listen better and use some trusted resources to get the right information out.
You know, one of the concerns I have is there are some of our health professional colleagues who sit on the anti-vax side, and you know, to me, that's just unethical. You know, if you really believe in evidence-based medicine, evidence-based healthcare, it's just ludicrous to me. You know that. You know, that one fellow I told you about that was on Coast to Coast, the physician here in town that runs that one group. Oh my goodness, it's embarrassing as a health professional to know that there are colleagues of mine that discourage and support the anti-vax movement.
Yeah, some of them are busy selling supplements on their websites also. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, we have a long way to, but I think if 99% or more physicians are, and I think nurses too, I think it's a really small minority, but they're pretty vocal.
They're vocal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They act as if sometimes they're speaking for the majority, and they're not.
No, right. They're a very small minority.
But if that's your aunt,
right,
who's one of those, and then the aunt who's a nurse that says, right, oh, I wouldn't do that, you know, you've got a double whammy. You've got somebody who's a nurse saying it and who's your family member, and that's hard to educate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. Well, and vaccine reactions do happen. Mm-hmm. They're not generally lethal, but they happen. And so it's scary for
I
say owners because that's what I deal with. Owners that have their dogs vaccinated.
I think the issue for a lot of folks, which has really been difficult for a long time, is the confusion between association and causation. Uh-huh. Like the number of times I've heard people, you know, got the flu shot, which has killed virus. I got the flu from the flu shot, but they're getting it, you know, at the time of year when, you know, respiratory illnesses are common. Or, you know, with MMR, it's like the first dose is between 12 and 15 months. And that's an age when issues like, you know, developmental disabilities or, you know, autism are first being diagnosed. So there's the number of severe reactions to vaccines and MMR is incredibly rare. And yeah, you can get a febrile seizure, but what I try to point out to parents is that your likelihood of a febrile seizure from measles is many orders of magnitude greater than your, you know, febrile seizure. And, you know, we're not just looking at adverse reactions to vaccine, which are incredibly rare, but compare the vaccine to measles, and what's more adverse? I mean, many orders of magnitude. And before vaccines, virtually everybody got measles. I mean, it's that contagious. So,
do you have a strong immunity if you give measles to measles? Do you have an immunity that lasts?
If you get the vaccine,
if you have had measles.
Yeah, you have lifetime immunity from measles.
The whole chickenpox idea. Not as
well, chickenpox, you get zoster, you know, you get shingles because you don't kill the virus. It kind of, chickenpox is a different disease. Varicella is a different disease altogether.
So measles is pretty protective. If you get,
you know, the measles protected virus doesn't stay in your, live in your body dormant like the varicella.
But you do
does.
Have protection against measles. You have natural protection from it.
But same thing with the vaccine. I mean, I get asked this question. The vaccine confers lifelong immunity too, which would you rather have? You know, how would you like to get that lifelong immunity by getting a potentially lethal infection or getting a safe vaccine? And the other point about this is, if we all got vaccinated, if we really did all get vaccinated, we'd have the same situation we have with smallpox. We'd eradicate it from the face of the earth. We don't get vaccinated for smallpox anymore because we're able to eliminate it. These viruses have to have a human host. I mean, they can't live outside people. So if we basically got everybody vaccinated, we ought to be able to eliminate, you know, polio, measles, you know, smallpox from the world. But as long as we're far short of that, I mean, polio's making a comeback in, what is it, Afghanistan and Pakistan. We should have eliminated polio a long time ago, but it's still out there. I'm blabbering, I apologize, but If we all got vaccinated, we wouldn't need, and it's ironic, but if we were all to get vaccinated, we wouldn't need the measles vaccine anymore. Sorry. But.
Okay. You're going to do a legislative update, too.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, you got to hear me yak a little bit longer. So,
well, I think it would be helpful because I think that was the take-back that I got. There was some information that I think they were concerned with, and what they wanted us to know is that the legislative aspect of.
Yeah, let me talk about the legislative aspect of it. So so one of them is foundational public health services here, and that's that ask. I think it's we're going with the OH to get ongoing funding for public health. Our original ask was, I think, $296 million for the biennium. The governor put in 22, and we're still trying to get more than that because 22 is ridiculously small, I think. We were predicting, one of the reasons we have this measles outbreak is because the public health system is underfunded, and immunizations are a good example. And this issue has come up by some of the anti-vaccine folks. They said, well, the exemption rate is 7% or so, but you're saying that only 80% of kids K through 12 are vaccinated. Well, the reason for that is that a lot of the kids in school are out of compliance, so that the parents don't vaccinate the kids, bring them to school. I believe there's a 30-day grace period, and the schools, as well as public health, are under-resourced to really chase after these parents who have not vaccinated their kids. So when we had the outbreak and we actually went over the vaccination rates in the schools, they were far, the number of unvaccinated kids was far greater than what you'd expect just from the exemptions alone. So one of the things we'd asked for, you know, a couple of years ago when we were advocating for foundational public health services, give us some more resources so we can work with schools to get those vaccination rates up. That's just an example. I mean, our communicable disease, all the, what we spent on measles is an example of foundational public health service. So that's actually doing well. The timing may be good. It passed the House, so it's now in the Senate. So the Senate bill is gone. It's now a House bill that passed out of the House. It's in the Senate. So that's moving forward. But if you can advocate for that, that's great. So there were two vaccine bills. One was, and I got an unfortunate story about this one. So one was the Cleveland bill, which would have removed the, so you all know what the philosophic exemption is, right? Personal exemption. Does anybody want me to explain that?
Yeah, why don't you explain it?
Should I explain it? So the state law requires kids K through 12, actually preschool, and to be immunized also. But there are exceptions. There's three kinds of exceptions that you can get to require the immunization requirement. One is a medical exemption. And the medical contraindications to measles, for example, measles vaccine, is really rare. It's a live virus, so if you had some sort of severe immunodeficiency, you couldn't get it. But it's really rare, so that's a very small percent of the vaccine exemptions. Another one is religious, also very small. I haven't heard of a lot of religions that say thou shalt not vaccinate, so very small. The vast majority of exemptions are, we call personal or philosophic exemptions. You just choose not to vaccinate your child. The state legislature made it a little bit more difficult a few years ago. It used to be, we actually called it a convenience exemption because parents would show up with their kids on first day of school, and they didn't have them immunized. And the school says, you can't come in. And the parents said, well, I'll just do this personal exemption. So the legislature made it more difficult. They said, you have to go to your child's healthcare provider, have the talk with them about the value of vaccines. And then if you still get a note from your provider that you had this talk, and then if you still choose the personal or philosophic exemption, you can sign a form and be exempt. So that helped a little bit, but vaccination rates have been dropping over the last few years. That's why we are where we are now. So there were two bills to remove, and this is what California did. When there was that outbreak in Disneyland a few years ago, California had similar statutes to what Washington has and Oregon has. They removed the philosophic exemption, and immunization rates went up in California. So there were
and
two
we're
bills.
And we're only one of about 18 states that allow that.
Yeah, I think there's still 18 states.
Maine.
Yeah, the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, and Washington are lax about this. So the Cleveland bill which is now dead, I believe, would have removed the exemption for all vaccines. But that got, as things go through the legislature, it's kind of like making soup or making sausage. A lot of really nonsensical stuff got added to the bill, including there was a list of vaccines that you could not be exempted for with the philosophic exemption. So they pared down the list, and then they removed daycares and preschool. So that ended up being a bill that was problematic. So then we had the Harris and Stonier bill, which was MMR only, would have removed the philosophic exemption for MMR only. I could have lived with that because at least that's a step in the right direction, and measles still scares the heck out of me more than anything else. The problem with it, and it passed the House, it's actually in the Senate, the problem with it, stuff gets attached to it. So the last version I looked at, basically said you could get a medical exemption if you have a sibling who is immunosuppressed, or you have a sibling who had an adverse reaction to the vaccine, which is nonsense. That's not a contraindication. That's the crazy stuff about vaccine virus shedding that the anti-vaxxers, so that, putting that in statute, saying you can get a medical exemption for something that doctors don't recognize and science doesn't recognize as a medical exemption, putting that in statute, to me, makes the bill worse than nothing at all. So it just codifies it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to happen to that. I talked to my counterparts at the State Association of Local Public Health Officials. We're going to try to deal with it in the committee and see if we can remove that nonsense. But it's really bad language that's in there. So the Representative Harris and Stonier were great. I mean, I think their original bill was real, didn't have any of this craziness in it, and they're doing the best they can, but when things get into the legislature, stuff gets attached, and that's what the problem is. Tobacco 21 passed the House, and it's being heard in the Senate Ways and Means, and it's not just Tobacco 21, I believe it's also Vaping 21, which we're hopeful will pass. So that's the legislative update.
Is there any, I think there was one more slide.
Was there one more slide? No, I think that's it.
Oh. There are a few more.
These are
actually bills that are hanging out, and I'm not exactly sure where they're at, if they're dead or not. They were being heard in the various committees and subcommittees. But since school safety is one of the priority things that we're looking at this year, the interesting thing is that there's a bunch of bills in there. There's a lot of public health associated bills in the legislature right now, which is actually great. There's one House Bill 1216. It's non-firearm measures. So basically what it is, it's about student health and wellness, but it has nothing to do necessarily with firearm safety. It has more to do with health and wellness and anti-bullying and that sort of a thing. However, there is a little provision in there that talks about lock it up gun safety. So there are some additional information in there about that. So that's pretty cool. The same thing here for Senate Bill 5027. This could provide extreme risk orders for at-risk people. So people who have been shown to be at risk, that have threatened suicide, attempted suicide, or are violent in some way or some other things. It would allow some protection orders to disallow them from getting firearms. And then also safe storage of firearms is in this bill as well. As far as we still know, it's still been there. And it's making its way through. Where'd Bob go? Bob's in the restroom. School resource officer definition and training is the Senate bill. And what it really seeks to do is talk about a school resource officer, what that officer is supposed to do, and provide standardized training for those officers across the board. It's really looking to expand that role because they've seen that that's been very beneficial. There's also Senate Bill 5514, school notification for area emergencies. Right now, a lot of times if there's an area emergency going on, the schools are not necessarily notified, talking about lockdown and that sort of a thing. It really is up to those local agencies to go, oh, hey, I need to call the schools. So this is one of those bills that would codify that would require that. So we think that's probably a good thing. And then Senate Bill 5689 is preventing harassment and bullying of transgender students. which is a great bill. I'm not sure exactly, like I said, where these are at, but this is just really a nice subsection of some of the things that we've been talking about before. So we want to make sure that we bring that information to you as we move forward and have some more dialogue around this. There's a couple of other things that were public health related that you might be interested in, Paul. Mm-hmm. The mobile food unit permitting. So basically what this would do is allow mobile food units to go through a permitting process that's more similar to some of our other restaurants. So that's what that is.
And that's it's like food trucks?
Food trucks, yeah.
Yeah, is that the same bill that required them to prepare certain amounts of their food in one building and then take it to the food?
I do not believe so. It could be that language has been merged, but I believe that was something separate.
That was something separate.
Was it?
Is it still the same that they cannot prepare some of the food in their cart, the food trucks? Do they still have to rent space at a true kitchen that is permitted?
Depends upon what the food preparation is and what the facility is. So this
varies.
But generally, you're right there.
People are still leasing spaces.
Yeah. And that's actually common, whether they can prepare food in the truck or not. It's still nice to have a commissary kitchen because there's a lot of prep you need to do, and you don't want to necessarily do that while you're sweating in your truck, right? You know, so there's still a lot of value in having those commissary kitchens. And then the last one is food insecurity and nutrition incentives. And this is really beefing up WIC and SNAP benefits for farmers markets to provide. It's really getting around food insecurity and providing more incentives and more more support for getting affordable healthy food to people who need it the most. So those are very great. There's several other bills that are public health bills. There's some sewer, on-site septic bills working their way through. There's several others, but these were just ones that we wanted to highlight tonight. So we'll keep keeping you informed about where we are with all of these. And if you have any specific questions or if you wanted some more information on any of those, you can just let me know. I can give you some more information.
I just checked and those are all alive still.
Thank you. Great.
They passed out of their house of origin.
Awesome. Great. Thank you. You never know.
Which bill were they specifically? What bill did they say? Were they mentioning specifically? Was it the not the Cleveland one?
The Harris bill. You mean talking about vaccination?
Yeah.
It's a Harris bill.
That's
Can you go back one slide?
Yeah,
it's 1638. So take a look at it because there's been some stuff added to it that's unfortunate.
Always.
That's a problem with getting stuff. It is a sausage making operation, and something can go in really good and come out really bad. But I mean, trying to put medical contraindications in statute that are not really medical contraindications, I think would be a travesty. So I've already said I'd rather have no bill at all than something.
And then you said the Harris bill was specifically MMR only.
It's yes. MMR only, correct.
So that's measles, mumps, rubella.
Correct. The Cleveland bill was originally everything, all the vaccine, the vaccine requirements, and then that got changed, and why some got included and not others. For example, chickenpox was removed, but it's really weird. Things like tetanus were in there, even though tetanus is not communicable disease. I mean, it's just mind-boggling as to how these things get put together, but it's not, I don't know who they're asking, but they're not asking, who's ever attaching these things is not asking the appropriate folks about what makes sense or not. Yeah.
So I share your concern because that just hurts the credibility of the public health professionals that know that those things don't make sense. So really disappointed to hear that is happening. Has the Public Health Advisory Council ever collectively offered up an endorsement or a letter on behalf of the council relative to these bills as they go through?
Generally, what I think the Public Health Advisory Council is advise our Board of Health about this.
Mm-hmm. So what Public Health Advisory Council can do is if there are specific bills or concerns that you have that you feel strongly that we would want to advise the Board of Health in one way or another, then that's something that you can put together. We would put together it based on the information, provide it back to the Board of Health, and then they can make a decision. So say you wanted them to, you know, to support Tobacco 21, that could be something that you all as an advisory council would vote on. You'd put it together, you present it back to the Board of Health, and then they can either take it up or not.
By the way, the one thing I want to say is Representative Harris has been a great champion.
Yeah,
he's a wonderful champion for public health. So I want to make it clear that he didn't put that language in there. That got added. And Harrison Stonier, I mean, I was really kind of optimistic at the beginning of this thing because I thought this is really an area where we can have bipartisan support for something.
Yeah.
And it started out that way. But Representative Harris has been a real champion in many ways. He's leading the charge on Tobacco 21 as well. He's been a real champion for public health. So I'll make sure, you know, he's not responsible. That language was added later. That was not in his original bill.
And he and Monica Stonier actually team up a lot in a bipartisan way. And their focus really is on health and wellness and community health and safety and community resiliency. So they've done some really good work together.
Yeah, they're great.
They're a good team.
Great team. Bipartisan, they work really well together.
Mm-hmm. This past weekend, I had the opportunity to chat with at least the 18th delegation. It really wasn't about this, but they were doing a town hall. And this topic came up, as you can imagine. And it was an interesting conversation because you had three of our representatives who have children who are immunized, who have skepticism about the bill or the bills. And the conversation wasn't about the science. It was about freedom and choice. And these universal notions in our society, in this country, about those things. And the balancing act between that and the science and protecting our community. It is a very interesting sort of public policy conversation. There were no arguments from those three about the effectiveness of immunization.
Mm-hmm.
It was about societal notions of freedom and choice.
So the issue about mandate and is this a mandate has come up. Are we mandating that people vaccinate their kids? And my response is not at all. Nobody's forcing people to vaccinate their kids. The issue comes up about if you're going to have your child in a congregate setting where there's other children, and in many cases in schools there may be daycares and infants there, I know there are cases of kids who are on chemotherapy that are in school, that if you're going to have your child in a congregate setting like a school where they're all day, that they should be vaccinated. If you could still choose to homeschool your kid. Nobody's going to force you to vaccinate your child. I hear that liberty argument all the time, but nobody's going to force anybody to vaccinate their child. That they can choose to homeschool. But the question I keep on asking is, where the freedom for parents who've got an immunosuppressed child who's
in school, baby and they want their baby,
or has a baby, brings their baby into a school, where do their rights? So I get that that's an argument about individual rights, but nobody is mandating that anybody vaccinate their child. That may not be a good enough response, but
well, when the surgeon
that's just what they were telling the constituents that asked them about their vote, and on the tobacco bill they were talking about that as well, and
choice.
They were split there too. We're planning to vote against it.
Yep.
Two voted against it, and then one's planning to vote for it because of personal anecdote.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
About tobacco related deaths.
Yeah.
In the family, and those anecdotes were motivating it. And I wouldn't be surprised that some of the 57 ayes on the vaccination bill, Harrison Stonier, became ayes because they felt like they could talk to their constituents after that language got added, and that's part of that sausage. I don't know if it was enough to get the majority, but it'll be interesting to see what happens on the Senate side.
When the Surgeon General was here, he was talking about this issue and about this is one of the biggest challenges from a national public health perspective is this argument of freedom, freedom argument. And he talked a lot about the social contract and how important it is for us as a community a small community, a larger community, a national community, to understand what that social contract really means. And it's about protecting all of us. And he was talking about that is one of the biggest challenges facing us today, is those arguments, and how difficult it is, especially in days of social media and other things, where you are able to get into those echo chambers, and it's just you end up with these intractable arguments. So it is a huge, huge, huge problem for public health, and I think something that we're probably going to be dealing with for many, many years, trying to, battle it.
I just want to say thank you on behalf of our communities for the good work, too. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was and is very intense, demanded a lot of the team, and so appreciate your leadership in that and the good work. And just professionally, I have curiosity. So is there like a tool? It's chasing the disease is epidemiology. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Is there is there an epidemiological tool where you're tracing all these contacts? Is there proprietary software?
Yeah, we have a database. Yeah. Actually, that's how we're going to be able to come up with the with some of the papers we talked about. We're really tracking that stuff. We're going to try to map it as well as we can. But yeah, part of the work is we have a huge database about this. So we're looking at, epidemiology is basically the science about how conditions are exist in a population. Things aren't distributed randomly, whether they be health or disease. So basically what we look at is, how these cases are distributed and where the contacts are and all that. But yeah, we may be able to regale you with some papers and some stories about what we were able to learn from this.
It's not a huge dartboard. I was just kidding about that. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I find epidemiology just really fascinating. And we use it for chronic disease as well. So
biostatistics involved in confidence levels. I took a class in that. Uh-huh. It was just amazing.
It's fascinating.
Forecast or
But some of the epidemiology is around vaccine safety also. There's been millions upon millions of doses of vaccine developed, and part of what epidemiology looks at is causality. So there's, when you're trying to establish cause and effect, whether it be a foodborne illness or whether it be a vaccine, a alleged vaccine reaction, you actually look at data and you look at risk factors and other things that are going on. And it's because of a lot of the epidemiology has been done that we know, for example, that people with the vaccine don't shed the virus and infect other people. That's been studied epidemiologically for a long time. We've looked at people who have been vaccinated and those around them, and there haven't been any other, thousands and thousands and thousands, big data, there hasn't been any transmission of the vaccine virus. So, yeah, that's why we're able to say that vaccines are safe.
Well, yeah, the safety studies that have it done. How many people have been that? We are the safety study. They don't need to test it on a bunch of dogs anymore.
Exactly.
if you went to one of the council meetings, they had a naturopathic student spoke up, and she said, well, there hasn't been a placebo-controlled trial of vaccines to produce, to show that they're safe. And I didn't respond to her, but I'm going to tell you that to this group, I've done research. I've done clinical trials. You couldn't get a placebo-controlled trial through an institutional review board, through an ethics review board, because you can't deny something that's life-saving to a control group to see whether it works. It would be like if you had a new cancer treatment and you were comparing it to a placebo. You would never compare it to a saline. You compare it to an existing cancer treatment, because you're not going to deny people. You could never get it through an ethics board. You can't do a saline trial of vaccines. So, but I didn't want to say anything at that point, because it ends up becoming an endless debate. But, millions of, the vaccine has been around since the 60s, and millions, probably billions of doses have been given, and it's a safe vaccine. But what am I going to, anyway, sorry. I'm passionate about it, if you haven't noticed.
Well, and I appreciate, Dave, what you said, and I'll pass that on to the team, because quite honestly,
yes,
they're the ones that have
definitely.
Been doing all the work. They're amazing. They really are. So I will share with them what you all sent here tonight. We appreciate that.
Well, I think when you've been on TV or in the newspaper, Dr. Melnick, you've come across as just having a lot of expertise and representing the team well. So
that's kind of you. Thank you.
Yeah. It's. I mean, that's a tough position to be in, but I think
it's going to be a reality TV show. Public health.
Yeah, unfortunately, well, it's been. You know, it really has been a nightmare.
We're going to try to do a montage of all the the press.
Where's your business vaccine tie? That's what I want to
say. Oh, I don't have. I have. You know what I have on today?
Ebola.
Yeah, yeah. You've seen it before.
Well, I just recognize, of course.
Well, I was just telling you, I was fortunate enough in going to work that I listened to NPR or OPB all the time. And he was on, and what was his name, Shapiro?
Ari Shapiro,
Ari Shapiro was interviewing him. I said, I know him, you know, so I'm listening, and I sat outside in the parking lot listening to the whole program, you know, and he should be a radio commentator, you know, he just comes across perfect. He should have a health program, some kind of a, you're right.
He's not flappable. The message is consistent. Yeah, and you don't get riled up by people asking you some of those tough questions, which I think is a strength of this whole response, you know, that we've had here in Clark County.
Some of the questions have been offensive, and I'll give you an example. A reporter apologized for asking this question, but and I had some talking points in my, you know, I've got the talking points that have been going through my head for 2 months. But did an illegal alien bring this virus in? And you know, and what I said, you know, I told her it was offensive and she apologized. She said she just had to repeat that. But I said, you know, the virus doesn't distinguish between Russian speaking folks or, you know, whether you're have documents or whether you, you know, where you're from. The only thing it cares about is whether you're vaccinated or not. So, you know, let's look at it that way. But I mean, some of the questions and some of it has been, and I talked to one reporter about this, some of it really shows who we are, you know, the kinds of questions we ask and, you know, the finger pointing and the blame. Mm-hmm. Even Ari tried to get me to say okay. something about the parents who are anti-vax and, you know, they care about their kids. You know, pointing the finger at somebody, one of the questions was, if you had a parent who didn't vaccinate their kid and their kid died or had a serious complication, wouldn't you ask them why? And I said, that would be like asking somebody who just died of lung cancer or is dying of lung cancer why they smoked all their life. What's the point in that? You know, what's the point of asking a question only to make somebody, you know, to point a finger at it? But I think a lot of this, even a lot of the questions we get is we try to think about a cause and we try to point the finger or blame somebody when it's really simple. It's a disease that still exists in the world and in the United States, and we have too many people who are unvaccinated. It's just as simple as that. But there's a lot of, I think we try to get a handle on stuff and try to explain it by blaming somebody or something. Anyway, I'm flabbergasted. I obviously can talk about this for hours, but.
So Roxanne, you're gonna have to be in charge a lot because I think doctor's going to be on the road.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Every state health association.
They'll be sick of me pretty soon, yes.
Hopefully you'll get an article out of this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. We expect it.
Actually, I hope our staff do. Yeah. I mean, we're going to have to do it after. But I think for our young, we have epidemiologists on our staff. This is an opportunity for them to otherwise do. And I think we have an obligation to disseminate what we've learned because other communities are going to be facing the same thing. So we're going to look at, like I said, how quarantine and isolation work. We're going to look at how immunoglobulin worked. We're going to look at a number of things that might be useful for other communities. Yeah, it's a chance for our staff to shine. I can pontificate, but what's been great about this is the incredible staff that we have in our health department that have done great work.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, so we have a couple of other updates. Is that okay, Adrian?
Yep.
As you've heard, we've been a little busy, and so the Public Health Community Award was supposed to be vetted. We were supposed to get that out and vet it in the community and that sort of a thing and get it going for the first week in April. We just don't have capacity to do it. So The award is very, very important, and we want to make sure that we recognize community members, both organizations and individuals, for their contribution to public health. But we're not going to have the award this year. We're just going to postpone it until the fall, where we have more capacity to actually do the work around it to get that on. And what's going to happen then is when we go through and we choose, we put the nomination forms together and that's vetted and all of that stuff, then our Board of Health will actually convene a meeting to provide those awards, both to the runners-up as well as to the awardees, mm-hmm. at an upcoming Board of Health meeting. So we anticipate that we can get all that together and do that in the fall sometime.
That's
so
good.
Yeah, so we're not doing it. We normally do it in April, but that's the reason why we're just postponing it. There's a couple of links and an article and a link that Lydia sent to you. And I think we have some flyers too. The Washington Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network is having a meeting in June. However, they have a lot of information too on their website. So this is a topic of conversation that we've been having. And so if you all are interested in either going to that networking event, they have actually special speakers and things that are going to be talking about it. The Lock It Up gun safety policies and procedures and all of that stuff are going to be a topic of conversation there as well. You're welcome to participate in that if you want, or go to the website. The other thing that we've provided is an article from the Dana Project on ACEs and resiliency. So if you have a chance to take a look at that, that's another area where we want to still continue to have conversations around and make sure that is part of our work. So I wanted to share that with you as well. And then meeting presenters. Kate Budd will be joining us probably in May. Our April meeting is going to be a joint Board of Health meeting. So we're going to have Kate join us, I think, in May. I'm also working with, as you all know, the Medical Examiner's Office joined us in public health late last year. And so we'll be having Nikki Costa, who is the operations manager, come and have some conversation about Medical Examiner Office and what she does, how it dovetails with public health, how they work with law enforcement, some other things. They're also a big part of our child death review, so at that time we'll also have an update on what we're doing with child death review and what kind of preventive measures we've had that came out of that organization. So I just want to give you a quick update that we're working on presenters. We've been a little delayed, but going forward, I think we're going to get back on track with regard to our topics of conversation this year. Any?
I guess I can talk about this. Gretchen, do you want to talk about why the meeting dates are
yes.
changed?
So the Clark County Council has decided to change their consent agenda meetings to evening meetings, and now they correspond to our normally held FAC meetings. And we need to have, Dr. Melnick needs to be there, sometimes our staff members need to be there, and they're going to try it out for a while in the evenings, but we suspect that that's going to happen for a while. So in order to make sure that we have, Dr. Melnick has availability, we have availability to be there when we need to be. And normally we have to be at every single one because there's usually public health issues on every single consent agenda. We're changing the date of our FAC meeting to the 4th Tuesday of the month versus the 3rd. The other thing is the April meeting for FAC is going to be on the 23rd instead. So that's just happens to correspond with the 4th Tuesday as well. That's going to be a joint meeting with Board of Health, and then we're going to be holding it over here at the Public Service Center, so you get more information on that.
Public Service Center is not where we usually have our meeting. That is here, that's around here.
The Public Service Center is right next
door.
The
big county building.
Okay,
yeah,
but it's over here. But
yeah.
That's where the county council meets.
Yep.
You'll send an address.
We will. And it's actually the building right next door here, okay. So you'll be able to park in the parking structure as well for the next meeting, too.
Okay.
If you get here around 5:30, you can park in the reserved spots. So that's, just FYI. You don't have to put money in the meter if you don't want to. Anyway, it only goes to 6 o'clock anyway, so if you decide you want to park somewhere else other than that, you can certainly do that. But we're welcome to park in those spots, the reserve spots, starting at 5:30 in the afternoon.
And hopefully that will work with everybody's schedule. We did look at our bylaws. It doesn't need to be voted upon the 4th Tuesday, but is that
maybe we should just do it for a couple of months and then find out whether the council is going to stay on that schedule before we change our bylaws?
We don't need to change our bylaws.
Oh, we don't.
Yeah. We don't need to do anything other than just make sure that everybody knows when it is.
Okay, good.
Calendaring it out.
But if any of you have any, I think we sent out a little note in advance, but if any of you have any concerns with that, just let me know, but hopefully that'll be okay and we'll move forward. Okay.
Are there any other comments, suggestions, updates?
Are we on that part about the council member update? Are we still on?
Yes.
Well, I have an update. I was going to bring this at our February meeting. Of course, it was canceled, but I wanted to share with, I have a copy for everybody, of the State of Our Children and Families report from, this is the newest report that South and Swell puts out. We work with the WAP Kids data and the ESD. And, you know, early learning is getting a lot of attention in the legislature. There are also several bills related to early learning in the legislature, especially children's mental health and looking at some of the issues in daycare. But I just wanted to point out, and I've shared this before, we're making some progress in Clark County. If we look at the WAP Kids data, which is an assessment done by every kindergartner entering public school in kindergarten by the kindergarten teachers about the child's readiness for kindergarten, which is really an early predictor of, you know, how well they're going to do in school and ultimately graduate from high school. In 2017, the readiness of kids in our state for kindergarten was 47% of our kids were ready for kindergarten in the state of Washington. In Southwest Washington, it was 48%, and in Clark, it was 53% in Clark County. And last time in Clark County, we were 42%. So we're seeing some improvement.
I'm on page 11.
And this is a bundled measure that looks at cognitive, social, emotional, math, English. There are six different domains that are looked at. So it's a bundled measure. Oh, here it is. Cognitive, language, literacy, mathematics, physical, and social, emotional. So it's the WAP Kids tool, which is done every kindergarten on kids in public school in Washington. So there's been a lot of emphasis and work in Southwest Washington on early learning, and we're seeing some improvement, but just think about the fact that only 53% of our kids in our community are actually ready for kindergarten in all six of those domains. So this is the second report of a series. The first one actually looked at the first WAP Kids data, and SELF will be doing another report in 2020 about the state of our kids. So it's just a report that encourage you to go, and if you want to read the first report, it's on the website. And we're getting up tomorrow morning. We're actually, SELF is actually going to be at the Chamber of Leads and Needs. We're reaching out to business, you know, and educating them, because children in our community, they're about our future. They're about, you know, in fact, Dr. James Heckman, who's a Nobel Prize winner in economics at the University of Chicago, has said we're foolish not to invest in our kids, because the return on investment in our kids is you invest $1 and you get a $14 return on your investment. And anybody in the stock market would jump at a stock like that. And yet, in our community, we tend our children and the impact, they tend to be invisible in terms of every policy decision that we're making in our community should really think about what's the impact on our kids. So so this is just a report for you all to look at.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. This is great.
Yeah, good work.
Did everybody get a copy?
Where do these go? Where do these go out to?
We try to get them out everywhere. Yeah. We're working right now with the business community. We've worked with schools, ESD, you know, lots of. So if you're interested in more, we can come and do a presentation on this, just like we're doing tomorrow. So, did you guys get one?
Any other?
Any cricket?
I don't need to make a
We're done. We're out of here.